Okay, this is...
We're exploring The Art of Game Design by Jesse Shaw.
A book of lenses. And now we're just reading through all of the lenses. We're not being particularly fair to the book because we're not reading the whole thing and we both have strong views on what a game is. We don't have time to read the whole thing and not the interest either. Chapter 10. Some elements are game mechanics. And we're finally getting to things that actually have to do with games.
Some elements are game mechanics? Have we not already established that game mechanics are a thing?
Yeah, some elements are game mechanics. Well, yeah, we did the elemental tetrad way back in chapter... what? 4. So now we're chapter 10, we're just entering upon
game mechanics. We're talking about a different kind of element here.
Yeah.
Since previously, game mechanics as a concept were a single element.
69. Just trying to... making notes in my... 171, in my... table of contents here. There are a lot of lenses in the game mechanics chapter.
Well.
So let's get right to it. Lens number 21. Page 135. The lens of functional space. To use this lens, unlike so many previous lenses, you do not have to stop thinking.
Well.
To use this one, you think about the space in which your game really takes place when all surface elements are stripped away. Ask yourself these questions. Is the space of this game discrete or continuous? How many dimensions does it have? What are the boundaries of the space? Are there subspaces and how are they connected? And is there more than one useful way to abstractly model the space of this game?
All right, that's kind of useful.
Yeah, absolutely.
We get to talk about dimensionality, like is this a side-scroller or a real 3D world? We get to talk about the discrete versus continuous is a cool distinction, I think, because you get to talk about worlds that have, like, distinct levels in them, or
right.
Even worlds where the games where the world doesn't need to be discrete if you, in your mind, but it actually is presented as discrete, like Arkham Horror and things like that, where you can travel to all these different places, but you don't have to travel anywhere in between. You just get to go from Los Angeles to London in one turn, because that's what you do. You don't have to think about how there is space in between Los Angeles and London, and they're all basically islands.
Right. Lens of functional space. I think he's talking, too, about thinking about your game abstractly. A lot of the mechanic stuff is about abstracting away all the trappings and thinking about it in terms of platonic ideals and things.
Sure.
And,
Is my room a square? Or is it a circle?
Well, he makes, like, a number of figures and stuff like this. You can see that, you know, just, like, lines and circles all connected together and things like that. Not even talking about the shape of the space, just, like... what kinds of spaces are they? Are they arranged in a line, or are they in a network? I think he talks about that more later when he's talking about the world, but...
Alright.
Lens 22. The lens of dynamic state. To use this lens, think about what information changes during your game, and who is aware of it. What are the objects in my game? What are the attributes of the objects? What are the possible states for each attribute? What triggers the state changes for each attribute? What state is known by the game only? What state is known by all players? What state is known by some or only one player? Would changing who knows what state improve my game in some way? Game playing is decision making. Decisions are made based on information. Deciding the different attributes, their states, and who knows about them is core to the mechanics of your game. Small changes to who knows what information can radically change a game, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. Who knows about what attributes can even change over the course of the game? A great way to create drama in your game is to make an important piece of private information suddenly become public.
So that made me think about a game that I played last summer, I think, called Eon Altar, which is a cooperative computer RPG in the style of a pen and paper RPG. And as an RPG, it's not super compelling, which is probably why it didn't do very well. The whole thing is on some pretty stiff rails. But as a technology demonstration, it was really interesting because one of the things that is really hard to deal with in cooperative games or nominally cooperative games like Dungeons & Dragons is information control. So the Dungeon Master is in the same room as all these people, and if he says anything out loud, they all hear it. So it's really hard for him to say anything to just one person.
Sure, you get passing notes and stuff, but right. It's not quite the same.
But even passing a note gives you information, because now you know some other player
has secret information.
Right, you know someone else knows something you don't know, which in real life you don't know when other people have secrets. You might assume they have secrets, but you don't know.
Sure.
And so the technology in Eon Altar was the computer game is all played on one computer, and it has a network server on it that everybody's smartphones hook up to, and then you control your avatar with your smartphone, and you get to pick all of your different spells with your smartphone, and you do your inventory management on your smartphone, and the whole interface to the game, other than the primary like representation of the game world, which is meant to be put up on a television or something, is on your smartphone. And so when the game wants to give you private information, it just puts it on your screen. No one else is looking at your screen, and it doesn't make a sound or anything, so
sure,
nobody needs to know. So it's even more effective than pen and paper games at conveying character-specific information.
Right.
And it had prompts in there for like internal dialogue for your character, because all the characters are also canned. And so you could kind of make decisions on behalf of your character that would then affect the dialogue that they would say. And it was really, really interesting. Unfortunately, it was not enough of a commercial success to enable the company to then go and do something completely different for their next project, which they tried to do and ran out of money, and now everything is dead.
Yeah.
So that's pretty sad. But I'm hoping someone else will do something similar in the future.
Well, doesn't World of Warcraft do something like that? Where you've got an app for your smartphone that allows you to manage stuff for the game?
Sort of. So World of Warcraft has a bunch of mini-games in it now, and the app on your phone essentially lets you manage one of the mini-games. It's a resource management thing where you have a bunch of people who work for you, and those people all have various skills, and you can either through the game client or through the app on your smartphone send these people and their skills on various missions, and those missions give you some small reward or another. So it's a similar sort of technology thing where you have multiple ways of interfacing with the game world, but it's very different wherein...
I guess you're not all sitting in the same room in World of Warcraft, so it wasn't a problem to begin with.
You're not all sitting in the same room looking at the same screen. This was a really novel approach to couch co-op games, which are becoming increasingly popular these days. They were really popular for a while, and then they got unpopular when everybody just started playing online games, and now they're kind of having a renaissance. And this was a really novel take on it that let you interact with really complex systems, because like if you've ever played Diablo 3 as a couch co-op game, it's a fun game, but it's really, really hard to interact with the game systems, and any time you need to do anything complex like inventory management or something like that, you have to inconvenience everyone, because now we're just looking at your inventory on the entire television, and you go through and you throw away all your stuff and you pick your new talents or whatever it is that you're trying to do, and everybody else just sits around and starts looking at their smartphones, and then you have to be like, hey, we're playing the game again, come back. And so with Eon Altar, you never really had to do that, because if there was, oh, I just need to do this quick thing in my inventory, you could just follow the next guy and go do it on your phone while you were following the next guy, and the game could keep going. And then if it was right before a big fight and it's like, okay, everybody, we need to stop and like make sure everyone has potions on their hot bars or whatever, everyone is stopping at the same time, and it's sort of a consensual thing, which was a big contrast to Diablo, where going back to town and selling everybody's inventory and all of that was this great big production that really fully pulled everybody out of the game, and you wanted to save it to an end cap, right? Like, let's do this at the beginning of the game or the end of the session, so that we don't have to completely break the flow of gameplay while we're actually in it.
Sure. So then what is the advantage of having the shared couch space? And why wouldn't you just have a game that's entirely on your smartphones and you could play with other people, or you could just play remotely?
Well, I mean, that's a whole philosophical question about why do people like being together?
Okay. Or people like being together and they want something to do while they're together that they can all share.
Yeah.
It seems like you could just get together and, like, do raids in World of Warcraft or play Overwatch or something.
Well, sure. And, I mean, we do that with LAN parties and things like that. But there's something maybe a little more intimate about everybody sharing the same information on their screen and sharing the same physical space. Because, like, at a LAN party, generally, you're not really sharing the same physical space as other people. You're sitting at your own table or your own desk or at least your own section of a table, and you're separated from everybody else, if by nothing else, by your arms as a frame, one arm on WASD and one arm on the mouse, right?
Yeah.
And so here, you're all just sitting on a couch. You only really need one hand to play the game. Your other hand is free to, eat food or drink or whatever. And so it feels more like hanging out with other people, even than a LAN party does. And I don't know if other people are anything like us, but most of our LAN parties, we actually wind up with headphones on so that we can talk to people in other rooms and other houses. therefore, making it even less dissimilar from just playing games at our own houses together at the same time.
Yeah. Huh. Well, anyway, shared information. Or dynamic state, I guess, was the point. But he kind of verged into game state knowledge there at the end.
Right. The controlling who knows what and how that affects the way the game plays.
Yeah. Seems like there should be two different lenses. Yeah, the lens of dynamic state and the lens of dynamic knowledge or something like that.
Yeah.
Lens 23, the lens of emergence. To make sure your game has interesting qualities of emergence, ask yourself these questions. You don't have to answer any of these questions, by the way. You just have to ask them, apparently.
Right.
These questions. Oh, well. How many verbs do my players have? How many nouns can each verb act on? How many ways can players achieve their goals? How many subjects do the players control? How do side effects change constraints? So these are all heralding back to points made earlier in the chapter about actions, and of course verbs, nouns, goals, subjects, and side effects. So he's trying to remind us of something that we haven't read, at least not recently, or at all.
Yeah, I've never read that book.
But again, this is basically just asking yourself a general question about game mechanics, like, can the players interact with the game, and are they trying to interact with so many things that it's confusing, or so few things that it's limiting?
Well, it's interesting that, and maybe the term emergence was used differently in 2008, but these days when we talk about emergent gameplay, we're talking about the game being played in a way that the designers did not expect, because they provided a rich enough tool set that their players could take the game and kind of make their own activity out of it.
Hmm.
And so you get things like the wars in EVE Online and things like that, where EVE Online is mostly an economy simulator, and all anybody really needs to do in EVE Online is run cargo from point A to point B for maximum profit.
Right.
And then once you have enough money, then you don't even need to do that. You can just sit in one place and play the market. But because the process of going from point A to point B takes time and has value to the players of the game, and because you can shoot at people, you wound up with territory disputes and the galaxy becoming segmented between entirely player-operated guilds. This isn't based on, you know, Alliance versus Horde or any sort of faction actually endemic to the game, but player gameplay and the way people played the game resulted in those same things, just like in real life, basically.
Sure.
Because the tool set that the EVE Online developers provided to their players was broad enough to make let that happen. You could make cool warships. It wasn't just a trading simulator. And you could have a robust and compelling economy. It wasn't just a space combat simulator. And they did both of those things well enough that when you put them together, the world mimicked reality in an emergent way. And so that's what I think of when I think of emergence, and that doesn't seem like he kind of brushes up against that concept in that lens, but I don't think he actually got all the way there.
He's mostly just talking about applying the linguistic metaphor to games, which is valuable, but yeah. I suppose if your game is Turing complete, you can do anything in it, and then it's just a question of how easily can you do these things in it.
Sure.
Lens 24, the lens of action. To use this lens, think about what your players can do and what they can't, and why. What are the operative actions in my game? What are the resultant actions? What resultant actions would I like to see? How can I change my game in order to make these possible? Am I happy with the ratio of resultant to operative actions? What actions do players wish they could do in my game that they cannot? And can I somehow enable these either as operative or resultant actions?
Seems kind of like he's doing a deep dive on his verbs from the last lens.
Yeah, it does. It's only a page away, so he hasn't had much time to talk about much more stuff. He talks about text adventures and how the text adventures were difficult to play, and because you had lots of different verbs, but not anything near the number of verbs that you could think of, and that the outcomes were always very restricted. So I think that's what he means by resultant actions, the things that happen in the game as a result of your input to the game.
Right. One of my favorite examples of that is, it wasn't a text adventure directly, but it was the original King's Quest game. Still was a text adventure at the core. It just had graphics for moving around and showing you the game world.
Right.
But it was still a set of rooms, and still all of your actual interactions, apart from just movement, had to be done by typing in move rock.
Sure.
And then if you were standing on the wrong side of the rock, because the rock would only move one way, when you move the rock, you slide it over yourself and murder yourself.
Because that's what any person would do in that situation.
Yes, you just pull the boulder over yourself and crush yourself to death.
And then it plays like that horrible little bang bang or whatever.
Yeah, I think it was a more drawn out, almost taps maybe, but it was more mournful than that even.
It wanted to really punish you for pulling the rock over yourself when you just said move it.
Yeah. So one of the more challenging encounters in the game was against this dragon that lives in the bottom of a well. And you get to the dragon, and just to get to the dragon is quite a chore, because you have to collect all of these things that you need for swimming that deep underwater and things like that. And you finally come out, and here's a dragon. And, it turns out there's actually a number of ways you can kill the dragon, which is pretty cool. But if you don't have a shield, the dragon just fries you, like, as soon as you walk in the room. And it's a hardcore game, so when you die, you have to start all the way over. So hopefully you are keeping notes.
Wow.
So you start all the way over, you find a shield, which, like, there are barely any clues as to where things are. So finding the shield might take you just as long as everything you previously did in the game. You find the shield, so now the dragon doesn't fry you as soon as you come into the room.
Right.
And so you've only got a certain number of things at your disposal. You've got a knife, so you throw the knife at the dragon. The dragon dies, and his carcass falls down on top of the mirror that you were trying to get from him, and he's too heavy for you to move. You lose. Start over. And so you've got a number of things you can do, and it turns out that the right answer is to get a bucket of water from the well and throw the water at the dragon, quenching his fire, and then he leaves in embarrassment. So that's actually how you beat the dragon. But because, you know, you do have a lot of things you can do. You can move things, you can throw things, you can fill things. You've got all these things you can do, but the game doesn't really have a complete list of them. You have to discover them as you go through the game.
Okay.
And it's a lot smaller than real life, so you have to imagine, you have to guess at, what things can I do? Because you know it's less than is possible.
Yeah.
But more than you have already thought of.
Ugh.
And so you have the entire space of the English language to work with.
Right.
Or at least all the verbs in the English language. And you can guess, well, they're probably going to be small verbs. We're probably not going to be typing somnambulate into this thing. But...
if only.
Yeah.
By the time you've beaten the dragon, you probably want to somnambulate through the rest of the game.
Yeah. So, paying careful attention to the actions that you give to your players and the way the results of those actions impact gameplay is definitely valuable.
Yeah. Or even having a key map, like, you know, remap controls or something like that. The great value of that is not even in remapping the controls, but just seeing what the inputs are.
Right.
And exposing that to the players so that they can see, oh, okay, that's a thing I can do. I can, like in Kerbal Space Program, I can turn lights on and off, or I can set the brakes. Oh, I didn't know that. That's really nice.
Right. Yeah. I do think gaming was kind of different back then. And
it was a different time!
Yeah. But it's kind of interesting because a part of the space that game designers were exploring seemed to be, can people figure out the puzzle that is operating our game?
Yeah.
And that's not really something that we explore anymore. I guess the answer came back yes, or the answer came back not enough people like this, or both.
Sure.
Probably both. And so either there aren't enough puzzles where how do I interact with this is actually interesting, or just it doesn't pay the bills.
Yeah. Man, that would be really cool to have, like, an interaction. You know, like in Minecraft where it's got the skill tree where you do something and then it's like, hey, this is the next thing you can do, and it links it over there. And then it gives you a hint that thing's possible without telling you how to do it.
Sure.
It would be really neat to have something like that in like a text adventure or something, or where you're, it's kind of unfolding like the Candy Box game. Do you remember that one?
Nope.
Where you start off and it's like, it's a flash game, and so you start the game and it's like giving you one piece of candy every second, and you're supposedly like going door to door getting candy for Halloween or something. And so like once you get a certain amount of candy, then you can like get a bigger bag, and then people give you like two candy a second, and then so you're spending, so then this candy becomes like a currency, and so then you start like increasing your candy levels, and then you're getting candy like mad, and then you like buy a castle, and then there's this whole castle management thing that folds out, and you're like putting down like candy windmills. I forget all this, but it starts unfolding, it starts flowering, and you've got all these different systems you start doing, and then it turns into an RPG. And you're buying armor, and you're running around on this world map, and like it just gets crazy. But it all kind of makes sense because it all had unfolded from this very, very simple thing.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd never seen that before. I saw very recently someone did something like that with the Paperclip Factory.
And it probably is the same, yeah, it's the same idea.
Yeah, it's just a website game. Like, you don't actually get to run around a world map or anything.
Okay.
But you start with wire and manually folding paper clips, and eventually advance to like a galactic civilization producing paper clips by the quadrillions.
If fun. Yeah. Yeah, that kind of thing. Anyway, it's it seems like the emergence that he had in mind, and the actions that he had in mind were kind of connected there.
Yeah.
Actions. Let's see. All right, lens of action. So he's diving into. Maybe he's going to have the lens of nouns.
Hang on a second, I need to make one crinkly sound.
All right. Lens of emergence.
Lens of crinkly sounds. Lens of talking with mouthful.
Verbs. Nouns. Lens of action is just about verbs. Lens of goals. Lens 25. We're still in mechanics and rules. Lens 25. The lens of goals. To ensure the goals of your game are appropriate and well-balanced, ask yourself these questions. What is the ultimate goal of my game? Is that goal clear to the players? If there is a series of goals, do the players understand that? Are the different goals related to each other in a meaningful way? Are my goals concrete, achievable, or rewarding? Do I have a good balance of short and long-term goals? Do players have a chance to decide on their own goals? And he notes, it can be fascinating to pick up the lens of the toy, the lens of curiosity, and the lens of goals at the same time to see how these aspects of your game influence each other. Which both of those were lenses that we had previously commented were pretty close to the heart of what make games games.
Yes. And I think this one is as well, where essentially in the lens of the toy, he talks about how when you remove explicit goals from a game, it basically becomes a toy.
Right.
And so now here we're looking at explicit goals, or at least at available goals. And so you're kind of looking at the balance between making a toy and making a game.
Yeah. I feel like there's a lot more stuff you could say about goals here. Like, a lot of games seem to produce the desire to achieve goals that are not actually achievable in the game.
Sure.
Which produces frustration, where, oh, I want to go punch that guy, but that's not an option, or I want to interrupt this cutscene and do a different thing than the character does in the cutscene, or whatever.
Right. Or way back in the day, you played World of Warcraft for a month,
yeah,
and all you wanted to do was explore places that the game didn't want you to be.
Yeah, yeah, I just wanted to climb up on top of all the mountains and climb on all over all the fortresses and stuff.
Right, but that was so counter to what the game actually wanted that they aggressively patched out wall running to make sure that people couldn't do what you were trying to do.
Yeah. They could have invented Assassin's Creed a decade before it became popular, but they decided not to.
Nope, that's not what they were doing.
Lost opportunities. So it seems like he's talking mostly here about the game designer's goals.
Well, the goals that the game designer communicates to the players, right? Like,
yeah,
we were talking about Warcraft 3 in the last episode. It gives you explicit goals. You know, you mentioned goals where you have to get these units from point A to point B.
Right.
Goals where you have to wipe out the enemy base. Goals where you have to find the MacGuffin. Right. So they're not the game designer's goals, because his goal is to make a game and get money for it.
But they're goals that the game designer put in the game, as opposed to goals that the player puts into the game.
Right, but he kind of alludes to that in his last question.
Yeah, he does, but most of the question, I mean, there's, 7 points here, and 6 of them are about the goals that the game designer has put in the game.
Yes.
Whereas some of my favorite games, like Railroad Tycoon, not Railroad Tycoon, Roller Coaster Tycoon. Mm-hmm. Roller Coaster Tycoon is just lovely. And while it does have designer set goals for each map, or can have, most of them are player set. It's like, well, I want to build a roller coaster that goes over here and there and has a loop over this place, or I want to build a really big one or a really small one or whatever. You can set your own goals.
Yeah. Roller Coaster Tycoon is kind of a really interesting take on the process puzzle game, where if you've played Space Chem or Big Pharma or something like that, you're given a set of inputs and a set of outputs, and you have to take the inputs and turn them into the outputs. And
in both of those games, all of your inputs and outputs are very tightly controlled, and you have tight control over all this stuff.
Well, so that's more true in Space Chem than it is in Big Pharma, and so I'm actually kind of looking at a spectrum here, where in Space Chem, the designer has complete control over the inputs and the outputs and all the verbs, and so the only thing the player can do is arrange the verbs in a way that manipulates the inputs into the outputs.
Right.
And so while there are faster solutions and cheaper solutions and things like that, the puzzle is always the same. In Big Pharma, as you play the game, you get a set of goals from the designer, like produce this much money in this much time or whatever's going on.
Sure.
But the inputs are game specific. They're procedurally generated at the beginning of each game, and so is the space in which you're working. So the puzzle is different every time. So that while the overall problem might wind up being a simpler one to solve than some of the complicated things in Space Chem, it has a little more replayability because you can play the same goal, which is kind of a Roller Coaster Tycoon type goal, and the scenario is going to be different every time.
Sure.
But similar to Space Chem, there are still better ways to accomplish your goals in Big Pharma. Where in Roller Coaster Tycoon, the big draw is building super cool looking roller coasters. And you have this goal that they give you, and so you want to build some roller coasters, but there's not really a wrong way to make money in Roller Coaster Tycoon.
Right.
You can lose in Roller Coaster Tycoon, but that you don't have to.
Yeah, there are always many paths to failure.
Right.
But there are many paths to success as well.
There are so many ways to do success in Roller Coaster Tycoon, and no one can really even tell you that you did it wrong or like you weren't fast enough, because speed isn't a part of the criteria generally in Roller Coaster Tycoon, and all they're trying to do is give you an excuse to make something that looks like a functioning amusement park and has the awesomest roller coasters in it that you can imagine.
Sure. Or just full of merry-go-rounds or whatever.
Right.
Which was the great thing about it, is that it had that element where you don't have control over your pieces, because the pieces are really the patrons of your park, the people that move around and pay you money. And they're just not, like, you just can't decide where they go. You could put a bunch of gates everywhere and kind of turn it into a Space Chem-like experience where as soon as they enter your park, they're shepherded relentlessly along a path into all your rides or whatever.
Right. Since they won't disobey a do not enter sign.
Yeah, the do not enter signs are completely infallible. Anyway, I feel like goals. Oh, and of course, Minecraft is almost entirely player goal driven.
Right.
So I feel like focusing, especially when he started off the chapter with emergence, focusing so much on the developer's explicit goals and not on the player's implicit goals is maybe a shortfall. But who knows? Maybe he'll come around to, like, this is just about the rules. Maybe he'll have, like, a chapter on the player. I think he does have a chapter on the player. Or did we already have a chapter on the player? The player was chapter 8.
Yeah.
The player's over. No more players.
Who knows those guys?
Anyway. Yeah, seriously. Just develop games and go direct to the computers. Sell games to computers. Mm. They don't call them computer games for nothing.
That's right.
Lens 26. The lens of rules. To use this lens, look deep into your game until you can make out its most basic structure. What are the foundational rules of my game? How do these differ from the operational rules? Are there laws or house rules that are forming as the game develops? Should these be incorporated into my game directly? Are there different modes in my game? Do these modes make things simpler or more complex? Would the game be better with fewer modes or more modes? Who enforces the rules? Are the rules easy to understand, or is there confusion about them? If there is confusion, should I fix it by changing the rules, or by explaining them more clearly? And then he has an entire paragraph. There's a common misconception that designers make games by sitting down and writing a set of rules. This usually isn't how it happens at all. Games' rules are arrived at gradually and experimentally. The designer's mind generally works in the domain of operational rules, occasionally switching the perspective of foundational rules when thinking about how to change or improve the game. The written rules usually come toward the end, once the game is playable. Part of the designer's job is to make sure that there are rules that cover every circumstance. Be sure to take careful notes as you playtest, because it is during these tests that holes in your rules will appear. If you just patch them quickly and don't make a note, the same hole will show up again later. The game is its rules. Give them the time and consideration that they deserve.
That seems pretty useful.
Yeah.
That paragraph is actually something I really hadn't thought about before. I've never thought about trying to design a board game in any real way. And I've tinkered with, like, modifying rules and making some new rules for already established role-playing game systems. But I haven't ever actually tried to produce a coherent rules system from the ground up. And so it's interesting to hear him talk about how imagining how one will play the game and kind of operating through that as you design the game board and the pieces and, you know, whatever's going on, and then working that into a set of written rules that people can use to play that game in a competitive or cooperative setting that's interesting.
Yeah, whenever I've designed a game, it does happen pretty much like how he describes it, where you come up with a few foundational rules, and then you try it and see what happens, and then you discover, oh, well, there's this really trivial, optimal strategy, and so then you try to adjust the rules so that it doesn't change the character of the game too much, but kind of balances out that strategy so it isn't so dominant, or things like that, and it is a very organic kind of thing where you kind of figure out, oh, this is how it works. Well, no, I hadn't really thought that someone would approach it from this direction, and so it turns out it works in this completely different way. The rules have these weird interactions and all that kind of thing.
Sure.
Probably the prime example of this happening is Magic the Gathering and Wizards of the Coast trying to put together... They release new sets all the time, and so they're trying to add new rules that don't break all the other rules that they already have in force, and don't make any kind of pathological interaction with any of the other cards that are out there. And essentially, each card is its own set of rules. Usually, they refer to rules already established, but sometimes they have a bunch of text on them that makes a fantastically different interaction, and they just do a ton of playtesting.
Yeah.
And I can't see how else you would do that. Maybe you could have, like, some sort of simulation engine that would just run through all the permutations of all the different things, but I don't know.
Yeah, Dominion comes to mind as well.
Oh, sure, yeah,
the Dominion. Where your rules are also your game pieces. It's going to have a lot of complexity.
And that's kind of both Magic the Gathering and Dominion are kind of a game designer's game, where you're putting together all these rules, and it's kind of a meta game, really, where you're designing a rule set that will operate in a certain way.
Right.
Lens 27. The lens of skill. To use this lens, stop looking at your game.
and start looking at the skills you are asking of your players. What skills does my game require from the player? Are there categories of skill that this game is missing? Which skills are dominant? Are these skills creating the experience I want? Are some players much better at these skills than others? Does this make the game feel unfair? Can players improve their skills with practice? Does this game demand the right level of skill? Exercising skills can be a joyful thing. It is one of the reasons that people love games. Of course, it is only joyful if the skills are interesting and rewarding. If the challenge level strikes that ideal balance between too easy and too hard. Even dull skills such as pushing buttons can be made more interesting by dressing them up as virtual skills and providing the right level of challenge. Use this lens as a window into the experience the player is having. Because skills do so much to define experience, the lens of skill works quite well in conjunction with lens number one, the lens of essential experience.
So, this brought Overwatch to mind, because I thought of Overwatch as, when it came out, as really kind of a triumph of incorporating different skills into a shooter game. So I've really never enjoyed any team-based shooter before, because I'm not good at shooting people in the head. That's just not a thing that my eyes and my fingers like doing. And so I really struggle to get good at it, and everybody else is already better than me, so all I can do in these games is lose, and that's not very fun. But Overwatch has a variety of characters where maybe being able to shoot people in the head is a bonus, but it's not the base requirement. And so the
for game functional is, competence.
Right. And then they have a couple of characters where it's not relevant at all until very high skill levels. So it enabled someone without the shoot people in the head skill, like me, to enjoy playing this team-based shooter style of game that has been popular recently. And I thought that was great.
Yeah, yeah. It does seem like there are a lot of challenges in games that are dependent on a particular skill and that don't really have to be. That you could probably map a lot of different skills, like you were saying with Overwatch, a lot of different skills onto the same kinds of interaction. Because Overwatch basically just has two, or I guess a few interactions. You're doing damage to other characters, or you're healing other characters, or you're affecting other characters' movement, more or less. But there are a lot of different skills that you can put in there, and it would be very easy. In fact, many other games have mapped a single skill onto each one of those elements and called it a day. And, I don't know, did you mention... It doesn't really mention, like, mapping different skills onto a single outcome, but I guess that's one place where it's nice to have more verbs that have the same outcome in the game, the same effective verb, or whatever you call it.
Right, and Overwatch really has done that, where they even have a healer for people who like shooting folks in the head.
Right. The headshot healer.
Yup. She doesn't actually get bonus healing for headshots, but
what?
You do have to actually land shots to heal people. And if you can do so, she's the highest single target healer in the game.
Wow.
If you can't shoot people, then she's pretty terrible, and you should play one of the other healers instead.
I think that might have been the healer I was playing, and it was pretty fun. But, yeah, the headshot thing, it seems like you should get bonus points for headshotting people with the healing skill, right?
Well,
how that works.
That's a whole balance thing in Overwatch, where certain abilities do and certain abilities don't get bonuses for headshots, and it's an important part of the way they balance the numbers. Or, because it is present at all, it becomes an important way that they balance the numbers.
So now we have a whole section on statistics and probabilities.
Oh boy.
And it goes on and on. And finally, at the end of this section, we get lens 28, the lens of expected value. To use this lens, throw away this book and take a class on statistics. No, that's not what he says. Think about the chance of different events occurring in your game and what those mean to your player. What is the actual chance of a certain event occurring? What is the perceived chance? What value does the outcome of the event have? Can the value be quantified? Are there intangible aspects of value I am not considering? Each action a player can take has a different expected value when I add up all the possible outcomes. Am I happy with those values? Do they give the player interesting choices? Are they too rewarding or too punishing? Expected value is one of your most valuable tools for analyzing game balance. The challenge of using it is finding a way to numerically represent everything that can happen to a player. Gaining and losing money is easy to represent, but what is the numerical value of boots of speed that let you run faster, or a warp gate that lets you skip two levels? These are difficult to quantify perfectly, but that doesn't mean that you cannot take a guess. As we will see in Chapter 11, as you go through multiple iterations of game testing, tweaking parameters of values in the game, you'll also be tweaking your own estimations of the values of different outcomes. Quantifying this less tangible element can be quite enlightening because it makes you think concretely about what is valuable to the player and why, and this concrete knowledge will put you in control of the balance of your game. So I'm just going to make a note here. 28 is the lens of statistics.
Pretty much. And statistics are important.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things that is important uniquely to games, because you don't really need to think about statistics when you're making a movie or when you're writing a book. Because, sure, people can kind of balk a bit when you say, oh, and then I happened to cross the business card of a prominent financialist, and he gave me $1 million, and then this happened, and that happens. Like, well, this doesn't seem very likely, but it's what happens in the story, so I guess that's what happens. It was likely enough. But in a game, you really do have to think about how likely is it that the player is going to do this, or that they're going to make this decision, or that whatever random event in the game will turn up whatever random outcome.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Lens 29, the lens of chance. Oh man, is this one the lens of statistics?
This one seems like it's going to be a lot the same as the last one.
To use this lens, focus on the parts of your game that involve randomness and risk, keeping in mind that the two things are not the same. Yeah, hang on, weren't you just talking about this? The lens of expected value, actual chance of a certain event occurring, that involve randomness and risk.
Maybe he's thinking about, like, if you have a game where you have a set number of resources, you can only spend 10 a turn.
Okay.
And you have certain abilities that have costs, and maybe some of them have cooldowns. How many times could you possibly do a thing per turn?
Right.
And does that have value?
I guess. Well, ask yourself these questions. What in my game is truly random, and what parts just feel random? Does the randomness give the players positive feelings of excitement and challenge, or does it give them negative feelings of hopelessness and lack of control? Would changing my probability distribution curves improve my game? Do players have the opportunity to take interesting risks in the game? What is the relationship between chance and skill in my game? Are there ways I can make random elements feel more like the exercise of a skill? Are there ways I can make exercising skills feel more like risk-taking? Risk and randomness are like spices. A game without any hint of them can be completely bland, but put too much in and you overwhelm everything else. Get them just right and they bring out the flavor of everything else in your game. Unfortunately, using them in your game is not as simple as sprinkling them on top. You must look into your game and see where elements of risk and randomness naturally arise and then decide how best to tame them to your bidding. Don't fall into the trap of thinking that elements of chance occur only around die rolls or randomly generated numbers. On the contrary, you can find them wherever the player encounters the unknown.
I continue to feel that this is very similar to the previous one.
Also, statistics.
The skill versus chance thing is sort of an interesting one, though. Something that World of Warcraft has done pretty recently. World of Warcraft being notorious for the amount of chance involved.
Sure. It's basically a giant casino.
Is they've put something in where you can, once a week, guarantee that you will get an item that is useful to you. And you can control the quality level of that item by exercising skill.
Huh.
If you can beat a dungeon on a super hard mode, and they have scalable dungeon difficulties now, so you can turn the dungeon up to 11, and in fact you can turn them up well into their 20s. But if you beat a dungeon on a skill of 11, even if nothing comes out of that dungeon directly, you will still get something at the end of the week, and that thing will be 11 good.
Oh, okay.
And if you beat it at a 17, you'll get something at the end of the week, and that thing will be a 17 good. And so you can spend the week kind of honing your skills, finding the right group and the right challenge, and getting to where, all right, we can do a 15 and get through it, and then at the end of the week, you'll get something and it's 15 good. So that's, that to me is an interesting trade-off between skill and chance that makes World of Warcraft a much more rewarding game than it was when chance was the only thing available.
Right, where you just have to hope that you get a 1% drop or whatever.
Correct. Well, I think, once again, we have done a thing.
Yep. We're up to Chapter 11. We finished Chapter 10, and, yeah, that'll be it for this time.
All right. We'll catch you next time.
And that's the end of the episode. Join us next time for more talking about game design book. Talking about game design. Talking about game design. Talking about game design.